Kelly Leonard, the Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. He hosts that Getting to Yes and podcast. You can find his stuff at secondcity.com or wgnradio.com. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, John. How are you doing?
Happy Valentine's Eve.
And to you.
You talk with Paul Eastwick and Eli Finkel about their podcast called The Love Factually, and I want to get to that in a couple of minutes. But I thought maybe we should start with, given the fact that you're Mr. Second City, about your connection to Saturday Night Live. What is that?
Oh, I think I've done more interviews about Saturday Night Live's 50th anniversary than I did about Second City's 50th anniversary.
Sorry about that.
It's fine. But it's probably because the format, you know, is essentially a version of Second City for television. Lorne Michaels, the creator, was in the Canadian comedy scene when we opened our theater in Toronto in 1972. But of course, Second City opened here in Chicago in 1959. But that first cast included Dan Aykroyd and Gilda Radner, who were both from the Toronto Second City, John Belushi from Chicago, and then Bill Murray the second year from Chicago. And that's gone on from, you know, the year it started to right now.
So Second City was a franchise, was a company that had these comedy or stand-up outlets, these improv outlets in Toronto and in Chicago.
Yeah.
They called it the Second City because of Chicago.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you also had an outpost in Canada.
Yep, yep.
And so I remember Second City TV with John Candy. That was the Canadian television version of what they were doing there.
Which was because of Saturday Night Live taking our talent. So the producer at the time, Bernie Solins, who started Second City here in Chicago, spoke to Andrew Alexander, who ran the Toronto location, and he said, I'm worried after they took the, you know, John and Gilda and Dan and the Billy, that we were going to just drain the talent base. So they started a show that in the first year was called Second City Television in Canada. And then Bernie didn't like the show, so he took the name with him, and they called it SCTV after that.
So SNL is up and running, and the next year then Canada figures we'd better keep our talent here.
Yeah.
But really then the very first cast was as Canadian as it was American.
Absolutely, yeah.
And yet Second City in Chicago predates Saturday Night Live by how many years then?
Oh, so by
15.
15, yeah. Yeah.
So you guys were doing it here on stage in Chicago for 15 years, then SNL comes along.
Yeah, yeah. Too bad it wasn't our idea.
It wasn't your idea?
Not to do the television show. I was young then, so I didn't start to work at Second City till the late 80s. But no, I mean, Lorne Michaels did a very smart thing. And, you know, he got that show up. No one thought it would work.
He came from NBC. Not from Second City?
No, he did not come from Second City. Yeah, he was a Canadian comedian. He had a double act. And then he wanted to produce a show, convinced NBC to put it up, and, you know,
then raided your store.
And raided our store, which is a smart move.
And were you okay with that then?
Well, they weren't in the beginning. So when I've been interviewed about this, what I know is the founders got very worried. And then when, you know, I came into Second City in the late 80s and then became the producer in 1992, working with Andrew Alexander, who was the owner at the time, we saw things a lot differently. We were like, this is great for us. Every person who goes to Saturday Night Live talks about their time at Second City. And, you know, when I hired Tina Fey and Amy Poehler and Rachel Dratch, and they all got hired by Saturday Night Live, something amazing happened at the Second City Training Center, which is we doubled the amount of women who wanted to take classes.
Nice.
Yeah.
To me, they're not synonymous, but they are similar. They are of the same ilk. More than that, I mean, to me, there's a kind of synergy here.
Yeah, it's sketch comedy. I mean, we create sketch comedy out of improvisation. That's why so many of the sort of really successful SNL performers come out of that world.
So how many Second City performers from Chicago then, writers and performers, made it to Saturday Night Live?
50.
You're just making that up.
I'm not. I had to do this. I had to go back and make the list because I knew everyone was going to ask about this. And I made the list, and it came to 51. And then our PR people looked at it and goes, you listed Bill Murray twice. It's 50.
So who have you personally hired or worked with then?
Okay, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Rachel Dratch, Horatio Sanz, Jerry Minor, Jason Sudeikis, oh God, there's so many writers. Matt Craig, Rich Tallarico.
When these people come through, maybe some of the names of the performers you just mentioned that we recognize, Rachel Dratch, for instance. Did you see it right away?
Rachel, yes, but no one else did. We haven't talked about this. So The other gal who was on stage when Rachel was there was Tina Fey. Now, Rachel was basically a local celebrity. Like, the audience loved her in a way that doesn't necessarily happen all that often at Second City. People like to talk about, like, oh, I saw them first, but you know, you're kind of making up maybe that you could tell. But Rachel was definitely looked like she was going to make it. She auditioned and didn't make it. So Tina Fey did get hired as a writer, and the next year became the head writer. So Adam McKay was the head writer before, also from Second City. So Tina becomes the head writer. And in those days, when Lorne and SNL turned you down, you didn't get a second shot. That was, it's different now, but that was the deal. So Rachel thought she was done, and that her career was probably done. So Tina Fey calls me up and says, hey, I'm going to be back in Chicago for the summer. I want to do a two-person show with Dratch. And I'm like, great. You can use the Second City ETC on Tuesdays and Wednesdays when it's normally dark. This is great. So, and Tina's not famous now, right? She's on the writing staff. She's going to become the head writer. She's not doing Weekend Update.
We don't know her.
But they put up this two-person show. And then Lorne and his producing crew come in the summer to scout Second City talent. And what Tina knew, and she never said this, but it's clear to me now what happened. Tina knew that she is becoming the head writer. Lorne is going to have to see her show, which has Rachel Dratch. The show was brilliant. It was called Dratch and Fey. You can find it on YouTube. It's very bad quality, but the show is brilliant. And Lorne hired Rachel after seeing that show. Hmm. And Tina did that.
What's the common thread among the people that graduate from one to the other or that make it?
Here's the common thread. Is none of the people who made it were thinking, I need to be on Saturday Night Live. All the people who made it were thinking, I need to do great work right now with the people I'm working with. And that's my focus. Hmm. And we say this to students, we say this to people we hire. It's like, keep your eye on the ball. Your attention is on your work, and your attention is on your ensemble and the audience. And if you concentrate on that, everything else will work out.
You didn't say that they're smart. You didn't say that they're intuitive. You didn't say that they're egoists. Are they some of those things too?
Sure. Usually not egoist, because you're taught to be an ensemble player at Second City, and that helps because you want to make your partner look good so they make you look good. They are smart. They're funny. They have point of view. They're playful. They channel any, you know, nervousness into like positive stress.
Do they have a sad backstory? They're not all comedians per se, but it seems to me like that's a common thread. So many comedians have demons.
Well, no one got into comedy because they're well adjusted. I can tell you that.
Kelly Leonard from Second City is here. He's told us a lot about Second City and SNL. One last quick question about it. So have you watched some of these specials, and are you going to watch the 3-hour thing? And do you think they've been doing the brand justice? Has it
oh,
been
yeah.
good?
No, all that stuff is terrific. And, you know, the music montage was, if you haven't seen that, like, go on YouTube. It's unbelievable. And you think about Saturday Night Live with comedy, but then, you know, they've also been chroniclers of music for these 50 years.
And you go, oh, yeah, that's right. But when you see this, you realize how they took chances with artists that weren't household names yet and then had the biggest names in the business, too. It's been groundbreaking that way. You host a podcast called Getting to Yes, Getting to Yes And.
Yeah.
You interviewed for that Paul Eastwick and Eli Finkel. Who are they?
So this is a little meta because I'm promoting a podcast on my podcast.
Yes, okay.
But these are two relationship scientists. So Eli is a professor at Northwestern, and Paul is a professor at the University of California, Davis. And this podcast they host, Love Factually, looks at contemporary romantic comedies, rom-coms, through the lens of relationship science. And you know, I work with a lot of scientists, behavioral scientists. I actually didn't know that there was a subcategory for relationship science. And it's actually relatively new in the sciences, the guys told me. It's great. It is a fantastic podcast. They pick a rom-com, and then they you know, discuss it, and they explain the science behind things that happen. Can I give you an example? Because producer Pete helped me out on this.
Got it.
So they talk about When Harry Met Sally, right? Which is, and again, we were just off the Super Bowl, where Billy and Meg did that commercial. And they tie in a concept that happens throughout that movie with a relationship science idea called motivated reasoning. So I think Pete helped me out here with the first clip. So let's play that from the movie.
Ooh, Ingrid Bergman. Now she's low maintenance.
Low maintenance?
There are two kinds of women, high maintenance and low maintenance.
And Ingrid Bergman is low maintenance?
NLM, definitely.
Which one am I?
You're the worst kind. You're high maintenance, but you think you're low maintenance.
I don't see that.
You don't see that? Waiter, I'll begin with a house salad, but I don't want the regular dressing. I'll have the balsamic vinegar and oil, but on the side. And then the salmon with the mustard sauce, but I want the mustard sauce on the side. On the side is a very big thing for you.
Well, I just want it the way I want it.
I know. High maintenance.
Okay. So, and that's a theme throughout the movie, right? So they're friends then. If you think about earlier in the movie, it really annoys him, her high maintenance behavior. And here he's kind of making fun of her with it. But I don't know if you remember this. The very last scene of the film where they're talking about their wedding cake. Do you remember this?
No, I do not.
Pete, can you play the clip?
We had a really wonderful wedding.
It was great.
We had this enormous coconut cake.
Huge coconut cake with the tears, and there was this very rich chocolate sauce on the side.
Right, because not everybody likes it on the cake because it makes it very soggy.
It's particularly the coconut soaks up a lot of that stuff, so it's important to keep it on the side.
All right,
so motivated reasoning is it uses reasoning to reach a conclusion that aligns with what you want to be true about your relationship, even if it isn't fully supported by the facts. He didn't like her being high maintenance. And by the end of the movie, he's basically high maintenance as well. It's on the side, because not everyone likes it on the side.
Well, is that him accommodating her, or is he now a high maintenance person?
It's making a virtue out of a fault because you love the person.
Yeah.
So it's changing the story. And, you know, that well-known philosopher of love, Friedrich Nietzsche, there's a quote that he has, which is, "Love is a state in which a man sees things most decidedly as they are not."
Well, it's an accommodation. We're different people. We're attracted to each other, but we're not the same. So I suppose that's maybe not intuitive, but it's smart to adopt that, right?
Well, here's the thing I love about science is because it tells you over and over and over again that it's all about context. So you can see how motivated reasoning can be terrible, right? And we see it in conspiracy theorists. We see it in people who are just going to, you know, they're going to vote one way, even though it doesn't support any of the things they actually believe.
Motivated reasoning. I am motivated to like this or do this, so reasoning be damned. My reasoning is going to be based on my motivation, not the facts on the ground.
But in a relationship, you know, some of that illusion, that's a good thing. Why not?
Right. What's the harm in putting the chocolate sauce on the side?
And for those who are in long-term successful relationships, I would suggest this is an aspect. So someone once said to me about good marriages is when each partner thinks they won. And I've said this to my wife, and we both think that.
Yeah, it's funny because, what is it, what's Gatesy's, the comic that we've been quoting? Nate Bargatze.
Oh, yeah.
he talks about his relationship and the fights that he and his wife are having all the time, which I don't know what they are, but the idea of winning or accommodating is kind of a common thread in some of his bits.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and the reason it's funny is because we relate and it's true.
Yeah. So the moral of that part of the story is to what?
I don't know if it's a moral, right? These are scientists. I think they're saying, you know, and the reason the podcast came about is because they teach classes on relationship science, and they were using movies in their class. And so they're like, okay, I want to explain motivated reasoning to you, but you're really going to get it when you see this clip from When Harry Met Sally.
Yeah, right.
And they also did Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. And they used that to talk about negative reciprocity. And if you remember that movie, Joel is Jim Carrey and Clementine is Kate Winslet. They have this relationship that ends terribly after like 2 years. So bad that Clementine goes to this company called the Lacuna Corporation and gets Joel erased from her memory. And then he finds out and he erases her from her memory. The thing that caused them to erase the memory is a fight they had where they get really insulting to each other. And they try to one-up each other with these insults. That's called negative reciprocity. And it is basically what the guy say is scientifically the predictor of divorce.
Negative reciprocity. Mm-hmm. You say something bad about me or do something, and then I
say it back to you, and then I keep doubling, and everyone keeps doubling down.
Yeah, well, I guess I could see that coming. I think we all know some couples that bicker. I don't know if we're talking about that, but there do seem to be some couples that feed off of or seem to be content to live that way. It doesn't look pleasant to me, but you've met people like that before, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's George and Martha, right? So, I mean, it's every couple I've seen who does that, they get divorced.
Yeah, right, I guess so. Kelly, we're out of time. I'm sure that's not the only movie or anecdote you have about our relationships, but you deal in these in this podcast that you just
Right? You guys should listen to the podcast and then download Love Factually. You're really going to love it. It's a terrific, terrific podcast.
It's about relationships based on things we've seen in movies. Kelly Leonard talked to the guys that do that. So I'm going to go to your podcast, right?
Yep, first.
And that's called Getting to Yes And.
Getting to Yes And.
Thanks for coming into the studio today.
Thanks, man.